Today on Vox Talks, coping with COVID in developing economies. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. With disturbing news from Brazil, India, and many other countries on the impact of COVID-19, the international community's attention is shifting to how we save lives and livelihoods while preventing long-term economic damage in less developed economies. That's the focus of a new ebook from the CEPR in cooperation with the International Development Policy Journal, and that's called COVID in Developing Economies. The editors are Simeon Jankov of the London School of Economics and Ugo Penica of the Graduate Institute Geneva. Of course, he's also one of the VPs of the Center for Economic Policy Research. And Ugo's on the line now to talk about some of the issues that the book's many authors have raised. Welcome, Ugo.
Hello, team.
Now, there was a brief period when we looked at the data from developing economies and we could hope maybe it won't be so bad there. Is that period over now?
Yes. So at the beginning, we hoped that warmer weather would slow down the spread of the virus, but it doesn't seem to be the case. If we look at the countries with the highest number of cases now, 6 of the top 10 countries are in the developing world. They are Brazil, Russia, India, Peru, Chile, and Iran. And infections are also growing rapidly in some African countries. And the situation is probably even worse than what we are measuring because testing in many developing countries tends to be limited. So maybe there are even more cases than that. So unfortunately, no, our hope at the beginning were wrong. So the virus is equal opportunity virus. It seems to be attacking everybody.
But on the other hand, many of those economies were quite quick into lockdown. Does that give us any grounds for optimism?
Well, some of them were. So in the case of India or Argentina, others were terrible, like the case of Brazil, which is now growing very rapidly.
Mm.
The problem, however, is that lockdowns in low-income countries are much more complicated and much more painful than lockdown in advanced economies. People don't have good dwellings. There are a lot of informal workers. So if you are somebody who's making a living by selling stuff on the streets in New Delhi, being locked down at home, maybe at home without running water, is much more costly than for somebody who can work from home or might have access to some sort of safety net. So yes, this might limit the spread of the virus, but the economic and social cost is much higher in these countries for, you know, many reasons: high degree of informality, higher initial level of inequality, smaller share of jobs that can be done from home. So we have several chapters in the book that discuss these differences.
Yes, and of course, I'm talking rather like developing and emerging economies are all alike. But also in the book, I notice you go into quite some detail on the contrasting experiences in sub-Saharan Africa, Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, for example. How much variation is there?
So there are large variations across continents and also within continents. You know, we have countries which are relatively richer, countries which are poorer. So if we think about sub-Saharan Africa as a region, the main problem is the massive level of poverty at which most countries are already starting. Again, with some difference, South Africa is richer than other countries. So if we think about the Middle East and North Africa region, there is a region that was hit by 2 shocks, the pandemic shock and the health shock like everybody else. Plus, it's a region that has many countries that produce oil, so the price of oil dropped dramatically. So these oil-producing countries are hit by a double whammy. And interesting enough, even the oil-importing countries in the region, countries like Jordan or Lebanon, are hit by the shock because this country would get a lot of revenues from remittances from citizens working in the Gulf countries. So again, a double whammy for these countries. Latin America is interesting. We have a chapter about Latin America. There is a lot of diversity within the region. So you have one country like Chile, which almost behaves like an advanced economy. It has a lot of fiscal space. It implemented counter-cyclical policies. And then you have countries like Argentina and Ecuador, which are completely shut out of the global capital market, so very limited fiscal space, and then countries somewhere in between like Mexico and Colombia. So it's a very diverse region. And then the other thing is the massive effect of the pandemic on tourism. So you have countries where basically there are no cases, you know, small island in the South Pacific, which have no cases, but these are islands that basically only live out of tourism. And there was a massive collapse in tourism. And again, we have a chapter showing this huge effect of the pandemic on tourism.
And of course, in many of these economies, there's a very large informal sector. There's a low tax base as a result, limited fiscal space. What policies that we would see in advanced economies does this rule out?
Well, so there are two things, the two elements that you mentioned is number one, the fact that there is low fiscal space, low tax revenues, there is less ability to spend money to protect the most vulnerable and also to scale up medical capacity. And also this joined with large informal sector, informal workers are harder to reach simply because, you know, we don't have payroll data, we don't know where these people are. So it's difficult to implement a program like we implemented, like the famous German program with a difficult name, which I cannot pronounce, but it says people are still given a part of the salary while working part-time or they remain attached to the firm. This is impossible to do with when you have informal workers.
So what's the alternative here? Because people need to be helped. There needs to be some kind of safety net. What is being done? What can be done?
Well, here, clearly, this would be the moment to scale up aid, to help country. You know, there was an article in the New York Times by the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, which said, at this point, we are facing a dilemma whether we should service our debt or spend money to save lives. So I think the international community should do something to prevent policymakers in developing countries and emerging markets from facing this dilemma. I guess that, you know, saving lives should be priority number one.
During crises, we also see in developing economies that conflict tends to increase. In this situation, are we likely to see an increase in conflict as well?
So we have a chapter by Nicola Berman and co-authors, which study exactly this issue. And so what they see two things going on. One thing is that in the short run, the effect of the pandemic on conflict has been that of reducing conflict simply because people go out less. And, you know, into conflict, you have to go out and, you know, demonstrate and do stuff. On the other hand, this reducing effect on conflict seemed to be smaller in countries characterized by higher pre-existing fractionalization. So these authors clearly, you know, they don't have a crystal ball to see the future. But what they say may be this fact that countries with a high level of fractionalization did not see a reduction of conflict even when people cannot go out. And at the same time, people are becoming poorer and with stronger perception that the government is not doing what's supposed to do. We also have a chapter in the ebook in which we look at perception of people. Maybe there is the risk that when people start going out again, conflict will increase a lot.
Now, we were talking a few weeks ago, Ugo, on video about the problem of capital flight. And that was not just from low-income countries, but from emerging economies too. Has that problem eased at all in the last few weeks?
Yeah, this is one of the most surprising things. So when we talked a few weeks ago, exactly our points, like we have to do something because this country will need to spend more. And at the same time, everybody's running away from them. Nobody's lending to them. And then something incredible happened in mid-May that capital flows to this country started going back. And so now there are massive flows to certain countries. Again, this is not a generalized phenomenon. So I looked at IMF data. So before the pandemic, there were 8 countries in the world with no access to the global capital market. Mm. At the peak of the crisis, when we talked, the number had gone up to 36. So, you know, a big increase, a 4.5 increase. And now it went down, but there are still 17 countries which have no access. So still twice as much as before the pandemic. But it was surprising that there was this sudden stop of capital flows, which didn't last much. And there was a sudden reversal. Now, we don't know. You know, this is partly due to the fact that there's been massive injections of money by the central banks of the advanced economies. We have to see how long this will last, whether these countries which now are borrowing will not be able to service their debt down the road. But this reversal was surprising to me and actually was surprising to many people I've been talking to.
Well, I mean, at least it's some good news for some countries, and there isn't much of that around at the moment, is there?
Yeah.
Now, what is the likely short-term impact that we're going to see in these countries on the poverty rate or on inequality within those countries?
Yeah, so we have a chapter by Giovanni Valenzisi who tries to estimate the effect on poverty. And these estimations tell us that the number of poor will increase by about 70 million. There has been a reduction in poverty over the last decade. So this means that we would lose the progress of 3 or 4 years. However, these estimates are conservative because basically assume they're based on the forecast of GDP growth and basically assume that the decrease in GDP growth will affect everybody the same way. There is evidence now that this type of crisis is not affecting everybody the same way. It's affecting poor people more severely than better off people. So it's possible that the increase of poverty will be higher than this conservative estimate of 70 million. There is a chapter in the book that shows who can work from home. Clearly, people who can work from home will have a smaller economic cost associated with the crisis because they will be able to continue to generate income even without having to go to their place of work. And this chapter shows that poor people are less able to work from home than better off people. So again, we expect that this crisis will have a, and there is a chapter that estimates by Davide Fulcieri and co-authors, which estimate the effect of this type of pandemic in income inequality, suggesting that income inequality is going to increase. So bad news, an increase in poverty and an increase in income inequality.
We're only just scratching the surface of everything that's in the book, but it shows how complex and multidimensional the challenges are for developing and emerging economies. So, of course, we think about the role of the IMF, the World Bank, other multilateral institutions at this time. What should their role be?
So I think the role is key. So there are some estimates by the IMF that financing needs of emerging markets would amount to 2.5 trillion.
Yeah.
And this doesn't even include the amount of debt that they will have to roll over in the next 12 months. So it's, the numbers are huge. Many countries already approached the IMF for assistance, more than 100 countries. The interesting thing, if you talk with people at the IMF, they got a lot of requests, but for relatively little money, which is kind of surprising. So a lot of small countries have approached the IMF, but the big countries, the one that would require very large packages, are not there yet. So that's an interesting thing. But, you know, this might happen down the road, and the role of the IMF and the World Bank is key. And I think that the main challenge for the Bretton Woods institutions would be to make sure that their scarce resources go to the countries and the people who really need these resources. So targeting, I think, is going to be the key now, not just lending to a country because that's been a traditional client, but try to identify where the needs are, both in terms of countries and in terms of vulnerable population within countries, so that their resources can have the maximum effect on the pandemic. But these institutions are also knowledge institutions. They have a lot of capacity of knowledge. They have seen crisis. So there will be defaults in this country. There will be needs to restructure firms, to restructure banks. And again, so the sort of advisory role that this institution can play is also very important.
Now, we highlighted the limited reversal in the capital outflows. Is there much other good news or positive responses that we're seeing at the moment?
Not much.
Oh.
So I was very happy in advance. People have different perspective. My perspective that the crisis is bringing out good things in Europe. I think this idea of the recovery fund in Europe is a good idea. I see less solidarity towards emerging and developing countries. The World Bank and the IMF immediately after the crisis asked for a debt standstill. And I think this was a good thing. But the private sector was not very keen in participating into this debt standstill. And to me, it seems that, you know, international solidarity is not what it should be. And, you know, some large shareholder of the Bretton Woods institution are constraining their capacity. You know, the fact that there is a global recession is limiting the willingness of advanced economies to increase their aid. And in fact, some of them might reduce them. Even think about even a country like the UK with allocating 0.7% of its GDP to aid. If the GDP of the UK decreases, even if they leave this 0.7%, the aid budget of the UK is going to go down.
Well, as we've been saying, there are very many challenges, and we can only hope for the solidarity that we need. If this book gets into the hands of the people who are responsible for that, then the depth of the thinking and the creativity of the ideas are bound to help. Let's hope it does. But Ugo, for now, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Now, if you want to get your hands on this book, then we've only just touched on the issues here. So it's a free download, of course, as ever. It's easy to find at voxeu.org, and the title is COVID in Developing Economies. The editors, Simeon Jankov and Ugo Panica, as I said. There's also a Vox column setting out some of these ideas, same authors, and that's titled COVID-19 in Developing Economies, a new ebook, and it gives a flavour of what's in that book, and there's also a link to download it. You'll read the column and then you'll think, I think I'll download the book afterwards. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks and you never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.